Hey everyone, welcome to another deep dive. For you, the learner out there listening in, I'm your host, ready to jump right in.
And I'm your resident expert, really looking forward to unpacking today's sources with you.
So, you know, you might think that winning a lawsuit ends kind of like a movie.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone loves that idea.
Right. The courtroom is tense, the judge finally bangs the gavel, rulings are made, and you walk out those heavy double doors completely vindicated.
With a check just magically waiting for you in the mail.
Yeah, exactly. We love the idea that a judge's decision just, you know, reaches into the losing party's bank account and makes everything right on the spot.
But if you actually look at the mechanics of civil law, that movie ending is, well, it's a complete illusion.
It really is.
Getting a judgment in your favor is often just the intermission, because the court doesn't automatically hand you your money.
Right.
The entire process of getting to that judgment and then actually enforcing it is this intricate maze of strict deadlines and procedural hurdles.
It's wild to think about. I mean, you could be 100% morally and legally right, have a piece of paper from a judge saying you're right, and still have $0 in your pocket if you don't know the exact next steps.
Precisely.
So today, our mission is really to demystify the actual machinery of the justice system.
Yeah, we're opening up the Pennsylvania Magisterial District Judge Rule Book.
The MDJ Civil Rules, right. We want to translate what looks like a wall of dense procedural jargon into a clear, understandable roadmap.
So you know exactly how civil disputes are actually fought, won, and enforced in the real world.
Exactly. I'll be trying to translate these dense procedures into some real-world scenarios for you. And our expert here will explain the why behind all these rigid rules.
Sounds like a plan. So to understand how a civil case moves, you really have to realize that before a gavel is ever banged,
or before a complaint is even heard,
right, before any of that, the court system requires three strict prerequisites to be met.
And this is where we start in the 200 and 300 series rules,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Before a lawsuit technically even exists, you need the foundational trinity of civil procedure.
Which is jurisdiction, venue, and service.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because I know people confuse jurisdiction and venue all the time.
And constantly.
So let's look at jurisdiction first under Rule 1515. Think of jurisdiction like having a VIP wristband to a massive chain of nightclubs.
I like that analogy.
Right. That wristband gives you the general authority to just be in the club system.
Mm-hmm.
Jurisdiction is purely about the court's authority to hear your specific type of case.
And in the MDJ system, this is created by statute. It specifically covers civil claims up to $12,000.
And that's excluding interest and costs, right?
Correct. Up to $12,000, as well as landlord-tenant possession actions.
So if you are, say, a contractor trying to sue a client for $50,000 because of an unpaid renovation.
The MDJ court literally does not have the legal power to hear your case.
It's just a hard stop.
It is. You can't just agree with the defendant to, you know, have the local judge hear it anyway. The court lacks authority.
Oh, okay. But let's say your claim is for $10,000. You have your VIP wristband.
Right. You're in the door.
Now you have to satisfy step two, which is venue, governed by Rule 302.
Yeah.
And venue means you still have to show up to the correct specific club where your event is actually happening. You can't just walk into the Miami location if your party's in the Chicago location, even if you have the wristband.
That's a great way to put it. Venue is entirely about geographic location.
Right.
For an individual defendant, the rule book says you have to file where the cause of action arose, where the transaction occurred, or where the defendant can actually be served.
So a court can have absolute jurisdiction to hear your $10,000 case. But if you file it in a county where neither party lives and no business took place,
you are in the wrong venue. Your case is dead in the water.
Unbelievable.
And assuming you do find the right location, you face the third foundational pillar, which is service.
And that's covered in Rules 307 through 310.
Exactly. This outlines how the defendant actually finds out about the lawsuit. And the acceptable methods are incredibly rigid.
We're talking personal service, right? Like physically handing them the papers?
Yes, or certified mail, or a comparable delivery method that actually requires a receipt.
The rule here is just brutal.
Yeah.
Because no proper service equals no proper notice.
Right.
If I just send a regular text message or leave a voicemail saying, hey, I'm suing you,
the judge won't even look at your case. Your hearing gets delayed or prevented entirely.
Wow.
What's fascinating here is why the courts treat service with such intense scrutiny.
Right. Why are they so strict about it?
Because it's not just an exercise in pushing paper. It's really the ultimate fairness check in the entire legal system.
How so?
Well, The foundation of civil law relies on the defendant having a fair, undeniable opportunity to know they are being sued.
So they can actually prepare a defense.
Exactly. The purpose is to provide concrete notice. If a plaintiff skips this step or, you know, tries to cut corners, the court just cannot, in good conscience, proceed to take someone's money or property.
That makes sense. It's kind of the ultimate you can't fight a ghost rule.
Yeah, perfectly said.
But what really caught my eye in the sources is how the court adapts when things get practically difficult in this phase.
Oh, you mean the flexibility rules?
Yeah. There are a couple of high-yield rules, Rule 209 and Rule 215, that show they aren't totally heartless.
Right. Rule 209 allows MDJs to grant continuances for good cause.
Meaning if you have a legitimate emergency, you can pause the timeline.
Exactly. But Rule 215 is really the modern one. It permits participation by advanced communication technology.
Which means using a telephone or video call.
Right. The court recognizes that the ultimate goal is resolving disputes efficiently.
Sure.
Imagine a key witness, or even the defendant, is a truck driver stuck out of state on a long haul when the hearing date arrives.
Instead of just issuing a default judgment.
Right, which means they'd automatically lose for not showing up.
Rule 215 allows the judge to adapt. Letting that person participate by phone makes the difference between a fair hearing and a procedural disaster.
But again, the judge only allows that if jurisdiction, venue, and service were perfectly established first.
So you've got your wristband, you're at the right geographic door, and you've officially tapped the defendant on the shoulder with the certified mail.
You are formally in the system.
Now the actual lawsuit begins, and suddenly you are on a very strict ticking clock governed by the 300 series rules.
Yeah, the civil case flow. It starts with Rule 303, which is filing the complaint.
Okay.
The plaintiff formally files their grievance with the MDJ, and that document kicks off the entire civil action. And from that exact moment, the stopwatch starts.
I was looking at this timeline, and it feels incredibly tight. Rule 305 states that the hearing must be scheduled between 12 to 60 days after the complaint is filed.
Right. No sooner than 12, no later than 60.
That's a really specific window.
It is. And it's designed to balance two competing rights. The 12-day minimum ensures the defendant isn't just ambushed.
Right. Imagine getting served on a Tuesday and being forced to defend yourself on a Wednesday.
You wouldn't have time to gather receipts, find witnesses, or consult a lawyer.
Makes sense.
But the 60-day maximum prevents lawsuits from just dragging on forever and hanging over a person's head indefinitely.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. What if you file the complaint? The 60-day clock is ticking, but the defendant is actively dodging you.
Ah, the classic evasion tactic.
Right. Imagine the person you're suing is hiding from the process server, refusing to sign for the certified mail, just living totally off the grid.
It happens more than you'd think.
If you hit day 61 and service hasn't been completed in time to hold that hearing, does the justice system just throw its hands up and let them get away with it?
That is the nightmare scenario for a plaintiff. If service cannot be completed in time to hold the hearing within that 60-day window, the complaint is dismissed.
Wait, really? It just evaporates. The dodgy defendant wins.
Not quite. It is dismissed without prejudice.
Okay, what does that actually mean?
In legal mechanics, without prejudice means the court is tossing out this specific timed attempt, but your underlying right to sue is perfectly intact.
Oh, I see.
The system refuses to let a stagnant lawsuit clog up the court's calendar indefinitely just because someone can't be found, so they close the file.
But the plaintiff isn't out of luck forever.
Right. The plaintiff can simply pay the fee, refile the complaint, and start a brand new 60-day clock.
So it doesn't let the dodging defendant off the hook forever. It just forces the plaintiff to try again.
Exactly. It's a calendar cleaning mechanism for the judge.
That makes practical sense.
Eh?
Now let's flip the perspective. Say you are the defendant and you do get served properly.
Okay.
Under Rule 318, you can notify the court with an intent to defend. Now, a lot of people might be terrified to file anything, thinking that interacting with the court means they are admitting they did something wrong.
That is a huge misconception. Yeah. Filing an intent to defend does not admit or deny the claim in any way.
So it's not an admission of guilt?
Absolutely not. It is simply a formal way of saying, I plan to show up and fight this.
Okay.
It preserves the defendant's right to present their side at the hearing. It ensures both parties are operating transparently before they actually step in front of the judge for the final judgment under Rule 322.
Transparency and deadlines.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean for the big picture? That's your standard 300 series civil roadmap for things like unpaid credit cards, broken contracts, or fender benders.
Right, the everyday civil disputes.
But then the rule book throws a massive curveball.
Yeah.
Because what happens when the dispute isn't just about money, but about the actual roof over your head?
Oh, that changes everything. When you are dealing with landlord-tenant disputes and the possession of property, the standard civil rules get completely abandoned.
Completely abandoned.
Yes, you move directly into the 500 series rules.
The shift in tone here in the sources is drastic. Why does an eviction or a property dispute require an entirely different legal universe?
It really comes down to the fundamental stakes involved. The 500 series recognizes that we are no longer just arguing over a broken contract. We are talking about human shelter and real estate.
The stakes are much higher.
Exactly. Because of that, everything from venue to service operates under specialized mechanics.
Let's look at venue then, under Rule 502. In the standard civil cases, you had a few options of where to file, like where the transaction occurred or where the defendant lives.
But in landlord-tenant cases, all of that flexibility vanishes. Venue is strictly where the property is located.
There are zero exceptions to that.
Zero. Uh-huh. If the apartment is in District A, you cannot file in District B just because it's closer to the landlord's house.
Because you want the local constable and the local judge who have direct jurisdiction over that specific piece of land handling the case.
Precisely. And service changes entirely under Rule 506.
How so?
Well, because of the extreme urgency of an eviction, where a landlord might have someone actively destroying their property or a tenant is facing immediate homelessness, you don't have the luxury of a 60-day cat-and-mouse game.
Right. You need it resolved fast.
So special service provisions apply. The rule actually allows for conspicuously posting the notice directly on the property.
Wow. So a process server can literally tape the summons to the front door of the apartment.
Yes. Followed by mailing a copy. It guarantees notice happens quickly.
So what does this all mean when you actually get to the hearing? This brings us to what I think is the most complex mechanic in the 500 series, which are the judgment options under Rule 514.
Ah, yes. The split judgment.
Right. Because the MBJ doesn't just hand down one singular verdict.
Mm-hmm.
They can grant possession, meaning the landlord gets the physical property back.
Correct.
They can grant a money judgment, which is for unpaid rent or damages. Or they can grant both.
And a critical rule to remember here is that a money judgment does not equal possession. They are two entirely distinct legal remedies.
Right.
A landlord might sue for both at the exact same time, but the judge evaluates them independently.
It sounds like the court treats the property and the wallet as two completely separate lawsuits running on the exact same train track.
That's a perfect way to visualize it.
You might win the wallet, meaning the judge says, yes, this tenant owes you $2,000 in back rent, but lose the property, meaning the judge finds a technical reason the eviction itself is invalid, so the tenant actually gets to stay.
Or vice versa. You might get the property back immediately, but the judge decides the tenant doesn't actually owe you the money you claimed.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, why is it set up this way?
Well, it beautifully illustrates how the law attempts to balance deeply conflicting rights. Shelter is a fundamental human need.
Right.
The landlord has an absolute right to their property, of course, but the law balances that with heavy burdens of proof. The landlord must definitively prove the right to possession in every single case.
And tenants have robust built-in defenses, right? To prevent families from being unfairly put out on the street.
Exactly. Defenses like payment in full improper notice, retaliation, or habitability issues.
Let's look at habitability for a second. How does a tenant practically use that defense in court?
Okay, imagine it is January, the heating system in an apartment completely fails, and the landlord refuses to fix it for weeks.
Sounds miserable.
It is. The tenant is freezing, so they withhold their rent money to force the issue. The landlord then sues for eviction due to non-payment.
Okay.
When they get to court, the tenant raises the habitability defense, arguing the landlord breached the implied warranty of providing a livable space.
And the judge has to weigh that evidence.
Right. If the judge agrees the apartment was uninhabitable, they might rule that the rent withholding was legally justified. In that case, the landlord might lose both the possession and the money judgment.
Wow. But if possession is granted to the landlord, it moves to Rules 532 through 535, which govern the order for possession.
Yes. The judge issues an official order authorizing the landlord to regain the property.
And the landlord doesn't just go change the locks themselves, right?
Oh, no. That is highly illegal. A constable physically executes this order on a specific date, overseeing the removal to ensure it follows the letter of the law.
It is an incredibly structured process to prevent chaos. Which really brings us to the final reality check of this deep dive.
The aftermath.
Right. We've navigated the foundational 200s, the ticking clock of the 300s, and the specialized property rules of the 500s. Let's say you do everything perfectly. You file on time, you take the notice to the door, you present your evidence at the hearing, and the judge rules entirely in your favor.
You get a massive money judgment against a contractor who scammed you.
Exactly. Case closed, right?
Not even close.
This brings us right back to our opening point about the movie ending. You have a piece of paper that says you are owed $10,000. The court clerk hands it to you. How do you actually turn that paper into cash?
You have to do the work. The court basically says, congratulations on your victory. Now go collect it yourself.
That is so wild to me.
The plaintiff must take active steps to enforce the judgment. The court does not become your personal collection agency. So welcome to the 400 series enforcement.
Okay, how does that work?
Under Rule 402, the winning plaintiff has to formally file a request for execution. Only then will the MDJ issue an order of execution under Rule 403.
And what does that order actually do?
It is a powerful written directive from the court authorizing a constable to go out into the real world and physically levy property to satisfy that specific judgment.
And Rule 406 outlines exactly what kind of property is subject to levy.
Right.
The constable can go after wages, bank accounts, and personal property. Imagine the reality of this for a second. You lose a lawsuit, you ignore the judgment, and suddenly a constable serves a writ on your bank.
Your accounts are legally frozen.
You go to buy groceries, and your debit card is declined because the constable has locked down your funds to pay the plaintiff.
It is a very intense mechanism, which is precisely why there are strict guardrails built into the execution phase.
And that's Rule 408, right? Covering exempt property.
Yes. The law dictates that certain property is protected and simply cannot be levied by a constable, no matter how much money you owe the plaintiff.
What kind of things are exempt?
Basically, things essential for basic human survival and dignity. A constable cannot take the literal clothes off your back.
Right.
They cannot seize Bibles or school books. They often cannot take the specialized tools you need to perform your trade and actually earn a living.
That makes sense.
And there is a statutory cash exemption, usually around $300, that is completely untouchable.
So the legal system allows a plaintiff to aggressively collect a legitimate debt, but it will not allow a creditor to leave a human being utterly destitute.
Exactly. There is a baseline safety net.
Now, while we're talking about the aftermath of a judgment, we have to look at what happens when someone refuses to accept the MDJ's decision.
The appeals process.
Right. Anyone who feels they lost out, the plaintiff, the defendant, the landlord, the tenant, any aggrieved party can file an appeal under the 1000 series rule.
They have exactly 30 days from the date of the judgment to file an appeal with the Court of Common Pleas in their county.
And the mechanism of this appeal is critical to understand.
It really is, because the appeal to the Court of Common Pleas is heard de novo.
Wait, I need to stop you right here. De novo literally translates to from the new.
Yes, it does.
It means a completely new hearing. The first trial is entirely wiped away. Doesn't that mean the first trial at the MDJ level was basically just a practice round? Why would the legal system waste its own time and resources doing the exact same trial twice?
This raises an important question about how the entire court system is engineered. You really have to visualize the environment of an MDJ court.
Okay.
It is designed for rapid, efficient triage. These courts handle massive volumes of civil claims every single day. Often, neither side has a lawyer.
Right.
The rules of evidence are somewhat relaxed to let regular people just tell their stories. It gets people in, gets them heard, and gets a decision fast.
But speed comes with a cost.
Precisely. Because it's designed for speed and efficiency, there is a distinct risk that complex legal nuances or strict evidentiary rules might get overlooked.
So the de novo appeal is kind of a backup.
It is the justice system's ultimate safety valve. Filing an appeal does not mean the MDJ made a mistake. It simply means a party is exercising their right to a higher, more formal review.
And the culture shock between the two courts has to be massive.
Oh, it's night and day.
You go from the relaxed, rapid-fire nature of the local MDJ court into the Court of Common Pleas. Suddenly, you are in a highly formal environment. The strict rules of civil procedure apply. The strict rules of evidence apply.
You almost certainly need an attorney to survive it.
But the 30-day window ensures that if someone feels the quick MDJ process didn't serve justice in their specific complex case, they have access to an exhaustive, formal legal battle.
It is a deliberate trade-off. The MDJ gives society the speed it desperately needs to keep commerce and housing moving.
Right.
And the de novo appeal gives society the exhaustive perfection of the formal law, assuming you are willing to spend the time and money to go through the whole process again.
So most cases probably end at the MDJ level.
They do, because people just want the dispute resolved. But the 1000 series ensures no one is permanently trapped by a rabid decision.
Wow. This has been an incredible journey through the mechanics of the rules.
It's a lot to take in, but it's so important.
To summarize for you listening, civil law isn't just a philosophical debate about who is morally right and who is wrong. It is an intricate, highly choreographed procedural dance.
Absolutely.
It starts with establishing the court's authority through jurisdiction, finding the precise geographical location with venue, and ensuring undeniable notice through service.
And once you are in the door, you are managing a ticking clock, the 12 to 60 day window of the 300 series.
And if you're dealing with housing and shelter, you navigate the highly specialized zero exception rules of the 500 series.
Constantly aware that winning a money judgment doesn't automatically mean you get the physical property back.
Right. And finally, a piece of paper from a judge doesn't pay the bills. The 400 series demands that a winner actively request enforcement and constables to actually see a dime of their judgment.
While the 1000 series stands by as a 30-day safety valve for a brand new trial in a higher court.
Every single one of these rules acts as a strict guardrail to enforce fairness. They remove the heat and emotion from a human conflict and replace it with predictable, step-by-step mechanics.
It transforms chaos into a navigable process.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you to mull over. Look at how intensely rule-bound this entire roadmap is, especially that enforcement phase.
Oh, yeah.
If the legal system requires a winner to actively file specific requests for execution, coordinate with constables, and know exactly how to levy a bank account just to get the money a judge already legally said they deserve, you really have to ask yourself a tough question.
What's that?
Does this legal system actually favor the person who is morally right? Or does it simply favor the person who knows how to navigate the rule?
That is the big question, isn't it?
It really is. Keep that in mind next time you imagine a judge banging a gavel. Thanks for exploring the mechanics of the law with us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.